Welcome to the podcast, One Wait Word, Jewish Questions and Musings, episode number 17. This is Andrew Turtis, your host, with my co-host, Michael Unterberg. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Andrew.
How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
I mean, we can tell the audience that this is a particularly busy day to sit down and record, but really glad we're doing it.
Me too.
You know, in a couple days, we're entering the Yom HaShoah, really the remembrance of the Holocaust here in Israel and abroad. And I was thinking of, you know, starting more formally and everything, and then when we were talking the other day, I mentioned that Shoshana and I are very likely keeping our 6.5-year-old son at home during that day because of mandatory Holocaust education from age 5 in Israel that started last year. Now, I'm still waiting to hear from his teacher exactly what they're going to cover, how they're going to do it, just so that we could decide.
What would be age-appropriate Holocaust education for a 6-year-old?
Well, the papers mentioned that the decision was, you know, starting with first grade. Well, it's actually for kindergartners, but with first graders, it's going to be a personal. It's not going to have any media, and it's not going to be graphic in any way, mm-hmm. and that it's going to be more to help kids deal with, one, there's a siren, what it's about, and what other programs that might be going around. Now, I don't know if there's going to be an assembly for his school yet. I'm still waiting on that. But what came to me is a couple of thoughts. One is, if, God forbid, our family was in a situation where, you know, similar to the Holocaust, there's no way to protect a youth from what's actually happening. So in a way, it's to even consider waiting for a later date to kind of share this.
It's a luxury.
It's a luxury.
And there are people who lived in different places and times who didn't have the luxury of shielding their children from horror because that's where they lived, in the middle of horror.
Right. And that's, you know, that is something that
is humbling, at least.
Yeah, at least. And
look, I can tell you, as a high school educator, there were moments where in Holocaust education, both in terms of the formal Jewish history curriculum in the school that I worked, but even in terms of informal education, whether it was Holocaust Remembrance Day, Yom HaShoah, or some other occasion, and I'm watching. I've had these moments where I'm watching the kids' faces and I realize that what I'm doing is destroying a beautiful layer of innocence that I felt responsible as an educator to take part in shattering, to educate away. And it happened to me 2 or 3 times over my career where it just made me feel awful, like I felt like Darth Vader. And there was one point in particular where what it made me feel, there was one moment, I remember this, I think I was in college running a program for high school kids, and I suddenly felt that I was forced to do this education because of what the Nazis did. And I had this terrible feeling of, obviously, tremendous distance from being a survivor of the Holocaust, being born much later, but that look how they still... We have a responsibility now to educate our youth about how evil humans can be because they proved it. So that they're still forcing us in more subtle ways, thankfully, but
right.
In somewhat disturbing ways.
Well, I mean, you put it in a beautiful way. And we face this in day-to-day experiences of, you know, considering how, particularly in the West and more in America than in Israel, where there's child abductions and where, mm-hmm. you know, there's moments where I'll be talking to Gabriel and he'll just want to, you know, walk away. And mm-hmm. This is not a place you can do that.
And Israel.
Well, though, see, I'm in a particular, we're in a particular crowded city setting,
okay.
during the Chol HaMoed. And no, I'm just, it reminds me of the okay, I don't want to tell you that there are people out there that
right.
make bad choices,
right.
evil choices. I know we're in a disagreement this moment, but now, and what was coming to mind is what you're saying is having to say something where you're actually shattering some innocence.
Right, but your point is well taken, that has to be an age appropriate. You want that innocence to survive for as long as it's healthy, so that becomes still ingrained, that perspective is ingrained, even if the particular innocence can't serve until adulthood. But you want that the kindness that should come from it, the positives, to survive the education.
Yeah, I agree. Last summer during the war, and there was many sirens, and I thought how we were able, as a family, we were able to protect the kids emotionally. I mean, we felt physically safe. I'd say most of the time. There's mm-hmm. a little times where it's uncomfortable physically, but and this is what I'm about to say is it's not a political thing I want to say. It's just the times of just a certain matter of miles away in Gaza, just thinking, wow, there are parents who do not have this luxury.
Right.
So I think just to go towards some of the what ways we in our community take such a complex, difficult, upsetting, horrific history, the Holocaust, and then where we are now, we're what, 70 years from then, and look at some of the ways that the way we as a society have been interacting with that, and if there's ideas of like how, like where we are in the barometer of dealing with it and coping with it, so we're working towards something healthier, stronger.
We're also at a turning point. You know, we're at a crossroads stage in dealing with the Holocaust, in that we're coming, you know, all survivors should live and be well, but we're coming towards the end of that generation, you know, whether that be in another 20, 30 years, 40, 50 years, but we certainly are coming towards the end of that era where we can expect personal testimony. And sort of the message of the Holocaust educationally has been for so long, you have to hear what happened. You have to hear what happened. Well, the historians have done a pretty good job of recording what happened. We have survivor testimony recorded. So now what? How do we go? What's the relevance going into the future other than remembering the event?
Right.
Is there such a thing as being overly concerned with the event? Can the Holocaust become too central in Jewish life? I think that's something we've been struggling with over the last decade or so. Culturally, you hear these people saying that it's being abused and overused.
Right. Well, I've heard it called the Holocaust industry. Then there, you know, that there's so many trips that are, I'm sure they're across the board as far as how successful they are, but in the survivors who go with younger mm-hmm. with college students or high school students and go to Poland, go to the camps, and you have programs, and that's, some of this is being critical and really successful in having emotional catharsis. And then some of them, Amy, it seems like I hear stories about where the programming is not done well, and there's something that just seems off about it, where the students are coming away like, oh, they crossed it off their list. They went there, and it's not meeting a kind of depth that is important to then.
They're not walking away deeply impacted. They've just had an experience without it really.
You know, then going to a party,
right?
Then going to partying in Germany or Poland or whatever. Although I was reading, and we'll be talking some about Professor Michal Govrin, who's a writer, poet, and novelist, and she's been dealing with, for a couple years, a program, Transmitted Memory Fiction and Fiction Group, Van Leer Institute in Jerusalem. Her mother was a survivor, but she didn't know that until she was at least 12 years old because her mother had plastic surgery to remove the numbers on her arm. So she's been dealing a lot with memory. And one thing she says about something about these trips is that she could understand why youth, for example, would go to the tour on the camps and then that night go drinking, go partying, because it's even if there is a deep meeting, it's so intense, there needs to be, it takes time to unpack that.
I remember when I was in elementary school, our music teacher was a survivor, and it was during, I think it was like a rehearsal for a Yom HaShoah event that the elementary school was having. I must have been in fifth or sixth grade. And the person reading the names of the camps, I don't remember what name it was, but it made the kids giggle. You know, just without thinking, reflexively, they just giggled at the funny-sounding German word. And our music teacher's face went white. And we panicked. She was a tough lady, my music teacher. We were all scared of her. So after this group giggle, there was, and seeing her face, everyone was terrified that she would be angry with us. But she immediately collected herself. She said, "Thank God I live in a world that those words sound ridiculous to children instead of horrifying." And it was a similar, that changing of the generations to her was a relief. Because it meant that, you know, similar to kids going to the camps, but then having the release afterwards. Because, look, I would argue, putting aside the issue of its abuse and overuse and however you want to talk about that, in terms of Jewish identity, I remember going to the local Borders when I lived in Cleveland and looking at the Judaica section, and they had two shelves in this particular Borders. But I've seen this in other bookstores. They had two Judaica shelves. And one side had history and religion and even a couple of Sidurim, I think, and all sorts of different Jewish life and Israel and holidays. And the other shelf was Holocaust books. And I bumped into that a number of times, and I was thinking, well, what does that mean? That half of Jewish identity in American Jews, you know, for American Jews in the second half of the 20th century is the Holocaust? Is that our center? Is that what motivates us? Is that our core? And to me, that was an expression of something off kilter in the relationship to the Holocaust. On the other hand, 70 years ago, a third of our nation was exterminated systematically, industrially, exterminated. And that's gonna have deep repercussions, not only for the survivors, but for the following generations for quite some time. And as Jews, we've lived through tragedy before, but in an age of media and photographs and self-awareness, I don't know how this process is gonna work. And so I think that's sort of what we're dancing around, is right, where are we now and how do we...
Yeah, do you remember when you were first introduced to the concept where you actually connected with how horrific it was?
I remember knowing about it when I was younger. I remember school assemblies where... And I remember as a little kid knowing that the middle school kids, like the 7th, 8th graders, were being shown footage, which I later discovered is Night and Fog, that French documentary that the French made not long after the war, using mostly British footage. And the older kids would say, "Oh, it's terrible, it's terrible." And also, my other connection was that I'm named for, my Hebrew name is Naftali Mordechai, the Mordechai is for my Uncle Mark, who was a survivor and passed away significantly before I was born. He went through the camps and then moved to America, where a cousin sponsored his immigration, but he wanted to return to Orthodox Judaism, and his cousin was not interested. So he just sort of placed himself in the back of a local synagogue in Brooklyn, near where she lived, and just sort of crashed there, not knowing what else to do. And an elderly Jew who was my great-grandfather, who I'm also, that's the Naftali in my name, brought him home. He lived with his daughter and son-in-law, my grandmother and grandfather. And he said, well, we have to take him in because he has nowhere to live and he's not going to eat her not kosher food. And my grandmother said, I have four daughters. I can't take in a teenage boy. But they did. He said, we have to. And eventually he married my oldest aunt. And they had two kids. And he contracted leukemia and died when they were very young. And my mother felt very burdened by that. She loved him very much and felt close. And was very, very helpful in raising this four-year-old and this five-year-old. My mother was, I don't know, 12, 13, I guess. And told herself she would name her first son for him. So, and to me, it's very beautiful that I'm named for those two men.
Right.
I knew that story as a little boy, that I was named for Uncle Mark who went through the Holocaust. And I remember watching, do you remember that miniseries in the 70s? I think it was on NBC. It had James Wood. I think it had Meryl Streep. The Holocaust?
The 70s? No, I mean, let's see. So I was introduced to the Holocaust probably around 78. And it was in...
You were unaware till 78?
Yeah. And it just in my weekly, once a week, Hebrew school, they showed footage is what I remember. And being... It did shape my experience.
Mm-hmm.
Like what you mentioned about the two bookshelves at Borders.
Mm-hmm.
Everything I thought of myself as a Jew since then was impacted by that, you know, tattooed.
I was less impacted by those images as a Jew, more as a human being. The shock of what human beings are capable of is something I've never recovered from. As a Jew, I was always more impacted by people in my family saying, when somebody would go to yeshiva or at a kid's brit milah or at a bar mitzvah, and people would literally say in my family, this is the best revenge against Hitler.
See, I didn't have that. My family... that was oppressed in the old countries were, it was by pogrom, and it was before those wars.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, my grandparents were either born in the U.S. or my father's father was born on the border of Russia, Ukraine, and made it to the U.S. around 1920.
Mm.
And my grandfather, who remarried my grandmother, came from Poland, but also came
before
20, you know,
between
before
the
20.
Wars.
Mm-hmm. So, and they had tough stories too, but the story was a whole different
mm-hmm.
story, not a hugely different time period, but a whole different story. You know, what is reading with Michal Gorin's work, It brings up questions for me. One thing is about that so much of the, you know, different memorials, like some museums and certain memorials and certain memorial programs are really focused on the process of killing that the Nazis had, and that the people who were ancestors, who were relatives, who were, you know, friends of our relatives, that in those worst cases, they don't even appear, and their stories and their memory don't appear, but what survives is the process of killing as icons and images, and that in some way it's like the procedure of terrors, I think, of Frisch used, that is surviving, whereas what I want to bring into this conversation, what she's working on, which I think in a later date we'll talk with her on the show, is that it's the personal stories which are what unveil the life and the life and what we want to bring back and to have the catharsis, which I really don't think as a people, as is in Israel and also as Jews around the world, that there's still a stuckness that, I mean, of course, there's so much people want, or in some cases so little people want to deal with this topic because of how heavy it is and how long it's been going on. But in a way, there's a way that we haven't really released it and got to kind of release the process of terror and murder and come to our own humanity. In a way, it keeps torturing us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was introduced to a school of educational thought by an organization, Facing History, that said that the goal of education about the Holocaust has to, you have to understand narratives and the experience of perpetrators, victims, and bystanders. That those are the three types of experiences that, to begin to understand what happened, you have to address. I don't know how successful I was as an educator at those multiple perspectives, but I do think that I'm agreeing with you that if you only tell the story of the perpetrators, then I don't think you've really begun to address what happened. Look, in Israel, we know that until the Eichmann trial, there was a beginning of a change. But in the early years of the state, there was no understanding of victimhood, because the young state had fought for its liberty against six invading Arab armies, and the enormous influx of survivors who came after the founding of the state were for the most part treated with derision. There was a common Israeli, they used to call them soap, because the Nazis, you know, famously were using rendered human fat to make soap from the victims. So it took until really, and part of the reason that the Eichmann trial was run the way it was to increase awareness of not only the perpetrator experience, but the victim experience, and how few options one had, and how rebellion took many forms, and it changed the way, it began the opening, I think, of survivor narrative, where people began to listen to survivors have them tell their stories.
Yeah, hold on to that thought.
I think that's a Deborah Lipstadt issue.
Yeah, Deborah Lipstadt, who wrote the Eichmann Trial book in the wonderful series with Next Book, Shuckin. She brings this up where the prosecuting attorney for the Jewish people against Eichmann, what's his name?
Hausner.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So he had this man named Baisky, who was in the camp, and he was really pushing him to answer, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you do something? Mm-hmm. And until the Mr. Baisky, you know, broke down, and he's an articulate man. He survived. He just was brought completely back into the helplessness of his experience in the camps.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of negative backlash to Hausner for choosing this method. And Mr. Baisky asked, you know, why didn't you tell me in advance? Why didn't you? And whatever, you know, not to justify or condemn Hausner's method, but what he achieved in that was to show that just surviving was an mm-hmm. absolute act of heroism. And that was missing from the understanding in Israel and in the greater world of the people who took a little extra slice of bread or saved theirs and gave it to a hidden child or something like that. That day in, day out, there were these acts of heroism. And that the armed struggle, which was completely important, you know, but that now there's just more understanding of this other heroism.
Yeah, it's not as emphasized as it used to be. I mean, the Israeli name for the day is Yom HaShoah U'Gvura, the day of Holocaust and heroism. And that because they were trying to find something Israelis would connect to, which was the partisans. But we today define heroism much more broadly, so.
Mm-hmm. I I think this whole topic is like peeling an onion. There's just so much that's been done, so much we can do. I want to return to this idea of, okay, there's two bookshelves in a Cleveland bookstore, and half of the books there on Judaism are Holocaust. Rabbi Irving Greenberg has a bunch written, and he has talks online about what was the Nazis were really trying to do and what they were so against. I'll quote him: "Nazis were determined to kill the Jewish message, the teaching of infinite value of human life." So it's not just that, oh, okay, they thought the Aryans it's not only that they thought Aryans are better, it's that in a way Hitler's message was a death message, like this obscene anti-life, and that by the fact that in Judaism that we don't really count people, that the traditional way is not to count except by non-counting or saying negative it's still a fairly new idea to me, and that some friends get uncomfortable if I ask how many kids you have or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the idea that, because we're not, that people are not numbers, each person is a world unto his or herself. And it's a profound idea. So in a way, this war, it's so huge, because it's about recognizing God, recognizing creation, and the value of life.
Right. Now, if I had asked Adolf Hitler if he agreed with Yitz Greenberg's interpretation, he would disagree, and he would say that it's the Jews who are eating at the core of vitality and life and corrupting it, and it's by eliminating that cancer that we allow life to be free and healthy.
Right. Well, there's a lot that Nazis,
which is evil,
would say. Is,
yeah.
Like Eichmann said, I'm just a cog in the greater wheel.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have been particularly visionary. But one of the Nazis killed after the Nuremberg trial, Alfred Rosenberg, was this intellectual philosopher who formulated this sort of racist ideology in those terms, which to them was a justification. Not that. In other words, I don't think they saw themselves as being anti-life. They saw themselves as being tough enough to, like the surgeon who's tough enough to cut into the flesh to save the life. And that's what they saw themselves as. It's a deeper... I'm not disagreeing with Greenberg. I'm saying if that's how they saw themselves, to me that's a matinee villain. And the actual Nazi movement was something much more complicated and disturbing.
Yeah, and insidious.
In effect, he's right. In effect,
right,
he's 100%
right. Right, because it's kind of like, sure, there could be a delusion that, I'm saving life. And, I heard Arya Rubin today, a talk he had given about the Holocaust. And he was speaking about Iran and about the willingness of current leaders to desire to blow up 5 million Jews and be willing to in the process lose millions, 5-10 million Iranians for the sake of that, so and justify it for life, so it's,
well, we've talked about this before. The culture, the Jews did not actually bring democracy as a form of governance into the world. That was the Greeks. But the idea that every human life has equal value and that value is infinite is Jewish. And that any culture that has embraced that idea, I mean, the Western world, what we think of as the more, to not speak in a PC form, what we think of as the more civilized world, has embraced that as their central guiding principle, and countries and nations that have not.
Right. Now, one of the things, given there's been, since the Holocaust, been so many genocides, and there's a genocide before in Turkey with the Armenian genocide, and then there's what's been going on in Darfur and Sudan and all around. And there's this issue of dealing with if someone really focuses on the Holocaust, that one could be... actually, I'll give an example of when someone was attacked for being, not a humanitarian, just being looking at one's own family. Actually, I have an example in Lipstadt's book. When I read it, I had an aha moment, because when I first heard the Holocaust, I had only heard of it in the original result of there being 6 million Jews that were murdered. And at some point, and I don't know when, I started hearing this 11 million number.
Yeah.
That there's 5 million non-Jews that were killed. And I was so shocked that why didn't I learn about this as a youth? Right. And so that is fiction. And it was Wiesenthal.
Yeah, she lays it at the feet of Sam Wiesenthal that he simply pulled the number out of the air as...
And he made it up to help the world appreciate connect. The 6 million Jews that were killed. But what happened is, so Elie Wiesel challenged him to prove and, come and show the world where this number come from. And what Wiesenthal said, he accused Wiesel of Judeocentrism, being concerned only about Jews. But, and I feel like I'm straddling this place of, a few places. One is total overwhelm for the genocides that are occurring. And then just by itself, the Holocaust, the overwhelm that I also have for that, and that there is a difference because of the methodology and the...
Well, yeah. I mean, the World War II was a very large event with, I think, like 60 million dead. So obviously many, many non-Jews and many, many civilians all over Europe and into Asia. But do you count, where do you draw the line between the Holocaust? If you're counting civilian casualties as victims of the Holocaust, the number's a lot bigger than 5 million.
But it's the victims of the World War II is right. What the large number is.
Then I mean, much higher of
Stalin's Russia, there's like that's 50 million even.
I think Mao has the largest, probably, number, Mao Zedong, largest number of civilian casualties under his rule. But look, obviously what I find disconcerting about that story about Wiesenthal is the truth is not Judeo-centric or non-Judeo-centric. The truth is the truth, and that should be paramount. I do think there is something to Jews being Judeo-centric about the Holocaust. I mentioned to you recently, I don't get why there's a Holocaust museum at the National Center, in Washington, D.C., as one of the major museums of the United States. If I think there should be a humanity museum that deals with human rights and crimes against humanity, and perhaps the Holocaust should be a permanent wing because of the scale of it and the historical record left, and the relevance of a Western industrial nation committing genocide. So it's certainly one of the central genocides of the 20th century, but I don't understand to this day. And I don't know that it's super healthy that things like Darfur and Bosnia are temporary side exhibits or small exhibits, and whereas the Holocaust is the museum, it's a Holocaust. I understand why Israel has a Holocaust museum.
Sure.
Yad Vashem. But I don't exactly get why the United States does, other than Jewish money and support and petitioning and organization. Which to me is, I would say, even somewhat troubling. And I think, the most often repeated statement in the Torah is treat the stranger well in your land because you were once strangers in a foreign land, implying that one's sympathy and empathy has to increase because of your experience. And you will very often find Jews at the forefront of fighting against or genocides, publicizing them, making movements.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think it's central enough in Jewish life.
Well, I think this refrain from the Torah, there's a, for the Holocaust, that never again is...
Which is hard to say with a straight face, isn't it?
Well, I think the question is what is the focus? What is our focus about the never again to us, never again to anyone else, never again? I think it becomes, has been used to say, never again will we be weak, as opposed to, I mean, there's different ways.
I guess that's what we meant.
Translate that.
I guess that is, but I don't think that's what we should mean. I think never again should mean not while we stand by. Not that we can prevent it. Samantha Power's excellent book about American foreign policy and genocide, The Problem from Hell, or A Problem from Hell, I think it's called, is, I think, well worth reading, and how difficult it is. The two largest types of organizations we have today are nation states and corporations. And neither one of them are designed to intervene in genocides going in other nation states. We don't have an organization that could do that. And then what burden does that place in a world with a lone superpower in stopping those things from happening?
Good question. What do you think the focus could be for us, so as a way to heal from the Holocaust as a people and as a nation, and also to shift all this huge energy that's right now, whatever amount of the energy is kind of stuck in a, you know, in trauma and not being effective with this issue, to kind of develop or advance where we are.
Well, your question, I think, fits more with your thinking. You're a healer, so you're asking me what are my thoughts towards healing.
Well, I thought you learned from Amanda that none of us are healers. We
facilitate healing. Right. I understand, and I agree with Amanda that the ultimate healer is God, and the process through time that the people go through will bring us through. I don't know. I don't think in terms of that. I think in terms of lessons. I think in terms of concerns. I think in terms of
okay. So what priorities? What lessons can we better learn right now as a people in relationship to the Holocaust and how we've been addressing it?
Well, to me, the lessons break down along those lines of perpetrator, victim, and bystander. And I think most of us end up in the position of bystander one way or another in history. And so to me, the first lesson is always, you cannot be a quiet bystander. You cannot. And you cannot be so parochial that you are unwilling to be a bystander on issues that relate to Jews, but are a bystander in issues that relate to other peoples, because that would be hypocritical. And there's not much to do is what's frustrating. Like writing your now that I live in Israel, I don't really feel so super comfortable writing, but I would to my representative. But I would write to my representatives and post things in social media to raise awareness, hang things outside my house. It feels inadequate because it is inadequate. But political pressure, at least, becomes incumbent on the Jews. And I think, you know, there's this rabbinic idea that when you pray to God for what's good for your friend, then it comes to you as well. And I think that in the modern world, we're so interconnected that I think the best self-advocacy that Jews can do is to show our concern for others, and that we're not parochial, and that we're not Judeo-centric, that we really do mean that every life is meaningful. And if Jews become the forefront of those types of movements in real time, in building a better future for the world, if the fact that Israel rushes to natural disasters often more quickly and effectively than other nations is to me a beautiful Kiddush Hashem, a sanctification of God's name. And we have to use that as a model also in human created disasters.
Right. No, that's beautifully said. And that is work of healing.
Right. I guess you're right.
Rabbi Irving Greenberg left me, not personally, but left me with some questions in his words. I'm going to read a few of them. Do we still believe that life has infinite value? And I think the way you're speaking about how to be active is a resounding yes. Mm. And another question is, do we still believe that good will triumph over evil? Another one is, do we still commit ourselves to perfecting the world? And one more, do we still believe that God cares and will usher us through to final transformation? I think just sitting with these questions also point towards healing, because it's choosing life, like actually saying, yeah, I do.
Yeah, to me, I don't entertain on a functional level. Intellectually, I can appreciate the question. Functionally, I accept them as axiomatic. I think they are Jewishly axiomatic. Well, the answer to all of those have Jewish axioms, traditional Jewish axioms. Are we building to a future of a better future? Well, yeah, of course. We believe in however we interpret it, it's deeply Jewish belief. Do we believe? Yeah. I mean, Judaism answers all those questions. Doesn't answer them. It doesn't ask. It almost doesn't ask them. I appreciate the intellectual exercise, but it's engaged in acting on the positive responses to all of those questions. That's what, to me, is so central.
Right. So, like, for me, going back to the idea of considering keeping Gabriel home from school during on Yom HaShoah or not, what I pray that he experiences is, and what I want to give to him is a feeling of safety,
mm-hmm.
and also feeling that he's becoming equipped to deal with what's really in the world, and both good and bad. And you know, I understand that I don't always have the luxury of standing between him and the actual experience that comes, but here's the case that the experience is, it's so huge,
yeah.
You know, this that I do want to mitigate it.
You know that Suzanne Vega song, she's actually coming to perform in Israel in a few months with the Israeli Philharmonic. She has a song called Night Vision, which seems to me that it's being sung to a child, and it starts off describing bedtime and how even though it's dark in the room, you can still make things out. But by the end of the song, you realize she's not only talking about the room. The last lines, I think, are, I would shelter you and keep you in light, but I can only teach you night vision. That's a parental reality that we have to acknowledge.
I love that. Just last Shabbat, we were walking down the stairs together, and usually the stairwell has a light on, and it didn't. And I love that changing light and using night vision. And Gabriel hasn't made that choice yet. Mm-hmm. He doesn't quite know. He just goes, I can't see anything.
Right.
I can't see Abba. I can't see anything. And by the time then we're down the stairs and he's still walking and he's fine. But it's that.
I can't always turn on the light for you. I can just help you see in the dark.
Right.
Yeah. And that's part of, I think, what Holocaust education is. Look, the most devastating part, I think, when I would teach the perpetrator part of my curriculum, I taught them Stanley Milgram's obedience experiments.
Oh.
Which probably is too much for us to get into here. Would probably best if we just create a link on the website. But, you know, this was not a German thing. This was not a Rwandan thing. This could happen in any country, anywhere. This is a human event. It's not a German event.
Maybe just one sentence on what it was.
Well, basically, to sort of oversimplify it, basically, This was in the 60s in Yale, I believe it was. And a person was brought into an experimental situation and told that they were part of an experiment of the effect of electricity on the learning process, and were asked to give another person who they thought was a fellow person off the street as a volunteer part of the experiment, but was actually an actor who was pretending to be naive, but was actually in on the experiment. And the person actually being, the experiment actually being performed on, was told, you must ask the student questions, and if they get the answer right, move on to the next question. If they get the answer wrong, you must administer an electric shock. And they were given a sample electric shock, which actually worked. But when the student, I'm making air quotes, was given, was set, hooked up to the machine, they were not actually hooked up to any electricity. If given a shock, they would say, ow, but it was fake. The teacher in the experiment, air quotes again, the teacher didn't know that that was fake. They thought they were actually administering shocks. And they sat in front of a board which metered how much shocks they were given, and were told every time they get something wrong, the next shock has to be at a higher level if they continue to get it wrong. And so they would turn up the wattage thinking they were giving them a higher shock. And they were ranged from painful to excruciating. And there was a range that said danger,
fatal.
Fatal. And the person, and the student, with the actor, was actually playing a tape recorder with pre-recorded responses to the different points on the array. You know, this is not good. I have a heart problem. I can't do this anymore. Let me out of here. I'm not participating in the experiment. And the teacher, who is the actual naive person in the experiment, who didn't know what was going on, the actual thing Milgram wanted to know was, if there was a university professor standing over your shoulder saying, please continue, the experiment requires that you continue, the authority of that person in a lab coat telling you to go on, how far would people go at administering shocks to a stranger? And the majority of the people did not stop until they gave lethal, what they thought were lethal dosages of electricity. These are Americans off the street, different walks of life, men, women, older, younger. Didn't seem to break down along any sort of clear demographic line, and there were variations of the experiment, but Milgram concluded, Milgram's conclusions are complex, but to reduce it to, if an authority figure takes responsibility, what does that do to me as a moral actor?
Yeah, that, I think that's a very powerful consideration when you're talking about the three subjects. You talked about perpetrator, victim, and bystander.
Yeah.
There's a book I've always wanted to read, Hitler's Willing Executioners by Plowshares. That
Daniel Goldhagen.
Okay, this sounds right. I believe it is dealing with this issue of, you know, willingness and
well, there's. Yeah, I would recommend Ordinary Men by Christopher Browning, which follows a group of Einsatzgruppen who followed after Operation Barbarossa, the Nazi invasion into the Soviet Union, which left in its wake the most dead centers of Jewish population on earth. And these groups were charged with their wholesale execution until 1942, but there were no death camps. The extermination of Jews was carried on a much more retail way. And these are ordinary men. And Browning goes through the records of their accounts, whether through personal test, sometimes literally legal testimony in trials afterwards, and how these middle-aged, middle-class men ended up performing these horrible crimes. I would also strongly recommend Jonathan Glover's Humanity, A Moral History of the 20th Century, which is a broader look, obviously, not just about the Holocaust, but in general.
Well, do we have access to Steven Spielberg's library, the Shoah, the recordings of survivors? Like, can we actually go in and listen to accounts, personal accounts?
I know that there was, that was certainly the plan, to create a web interface. I've never accessed it, but I would imagine there is.
So I'll look into that, and, you know, this episode will come on really just within a day of Yom HaShoah, and, you know, as we always do, to invite your input as our audience, if there's any specific resource or personal accounts that are audio or video, I'd be happy to post them on the webpage, so please contact us.
And also, if you agree or disagree with things in our perspective or wanted to add or share, it's a very complex issue that really needs a lot of talking through.
Right, and being at this time, really right between Passover and this experience, and in another week, there's the Memorial Day, Yom HaZikaron, for fallen Israelis during the various struggles, that then goes right into Independence Day, Yom HaTzma'ut. So next episode, we'll look at kind of that choreography of events, really, to put that into more context as well. Anything you want to add, Michael?
No, I'm looking forward to the Yom HaTzma'ut, getting through to the Yom HaTzma'ut part, because it's a rough ride from Yom HaShoah to Yom HaZikaron.
Right, and we're all just babies having come across the Red Sea, still kind of getting seaweed off our pants.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for listening. We look forward to hearing from you. Please visit us online at oneway.com.
Don't forget to check us out on Facebook and Twitter at One Way Our Podcast.
And thank you for the latest comments. Our music is brought to you by Saul K., Jewish blues pioneer.
Bye.
Bye.